This is Counterculture with Marie Buskey, Wednesdays at 10 a.m. on Reality Check Radio.
Good morning. Welcome back to Counterculture here on Reality Check Radio. You are with Marie. Joining me now is Nicholas Shepherd. For many of you who are in the YouTube space and love some content on popular culture, you may know him as Echo Chamberlain with his very successful YouTube channel. Nicholas, good morning and welcome to Counterculture. I'm really excited to have you here. I'm very excited. So it's so good to have you along today.
Well, good morning, Marie. It's great to be home with you. Looking forward to it.
No, I'm really looking forward to it too. And I'm going to read you a quote. And this is from one of your shows several months ago. And it says, "It sucked so much ass, the suction was able to invert the testicles and wind them through hurtling pressure, through internal workings, past the prostate, through the rectum, so it sucked balls simultaneously as it sucked ass." What movie were you referring to and why?
Gee, that could have been any number of products out of the Hollywood machine. I thought you were going to quote something profound, some delicate rhetorical construction that I labored over, but you went with that. So I guess
I went with that. I know. I was painted a very distinct visual picture because one of my favorite sayings for some of these people is they have got a grandstand view of the inside of their own anus. So, you know. Mm-hmm. It tickled my fancy. So it was.
Take away one syllable and the whole delicate epigram collapses.
Exactly. So, yes, the film you were referring to was the reboot of Ghostbusters.
Oh, yeah.
And you were not fond.
Not particularly. No, it's just one of another of maybe a dozen franchises that are beloved from many people's childhoods that have been desecrated, ransacked, co-opted, and bastardized. With all the soul and the spirit and the joy sapped out of them and replaced with tedious identity politics and very sort of flaky characterization where you don't fall in love with any characters, you don't particularly follow any narrative arc, you just sort of consume sloppy product, sort of imagine or will yourself into the idea that you're actually enjoying it. And, you know, you look around in the cinema at the five or six other people, the smattering of pensioners out for the day who have come along. And then you leave the cinema and you don't feel any bitter for it. So it's a shame.
Now, and that film in the video that you referred to, you referred to this woman, was sort of kind of like a beginning, wasn't it? Like it sent a very clear message of the direction that Hollywood was wanting to go in, and it wasn't good.
Yeah, it was sort of the beginning of that trajectory of massive reboots where the big Hollywood studios have decided that there's so much money just in reboots and rehashes and reimaginings, you know, for a new generation. And you put in some sort of identity or cultural swaps in there. And a lot of these showrunners and writers who come from a social milieu in California, they've come to think that changing identity, you know, gender, race, sexual orientation of characters sort of has the contours of being new or sort of the contours of being original. And so I made the other analogy that they couldn't build the house, so they become fussily obsessive about shifting around the furniture and changing the decor. That's not originality. People want original and new stories, and people are very open to, you know, modern ideas of identity as long as there are new products. There's shows like Arcane that me and the sort of YouTube ecosystem love. And, it couldn't be more sort of progressive. But if the stories are new, the characterization is sharp and whip smart, then people are up for it. But it's this same problem over and over of taking existing IPs and properties that you had no part in constructing, no part in building a long-time generational audience for, and then you neglect that long-term audience who could be shepherding in a new one for you, and instead you slather it with your own identity preoccupations, and it ends up turning off audiences and people just voting with their wallets. Mm. And it's been carnage out there with these failing franchises bombing over and over. You know, you have a game like Concord came out and Sony invested up to $400 million in it. And at its peak on like Steam, this online thing where people can play, it had 660 people playing. And so they just took it off and they gave people a refund after about 8 days. And that's a $400 million product. The Marvels lost, I think, like $200 million. Indiana Jones bombed at the box office. And there's just one after another. And I think the studio machines are struggling to learn this.
Yeah. Well, I mean, we're going to dive down the Disney path, because it's funny you should mention that. I looked up some numbers before we got started, and Disney in 2023 in their streaming and movie section lost $505 million. They were very excited because in the last fiscal year, they only lost 19.
Yeah. They get, because Disney basically owns everything. So they own the Marvel Studios, they own Lucasfilm that does Star Wars, they own Pixar, which does all those kids' films. And so when they rehash Inside Out with Inside Out 2, and then they did Deadpool and Wolverine, huge smashes. But again, just looking backwards and relying on beloved characters and the interrelationship between those two beloved characters, when they try to do something new, or you know, the whole bunch of other stuff that they do, tends to fail pretty miserably. And it's really kind of dispiriting. There was a year or two ago, they did a Peter Pan rehash, where, of course, Wendy is super empowered. And rather than have the sparky, enigmatic, wildfire excitement of Peter Pan, he's kind of like morose and subdued. And at one point, Wendy actually slaps him to the ground. And this is like a month apart from when there's an Indiana Jones film, where Indiana Jones is too morose and gets knocked out by his strong, plucky female companion. And on and on and on, the same tropes that just kind of turning people off.
Well, for me, one of the ones in recent times has been Star Wars, because I'm old enough to remember going to the original one. So when I was a little tacker. Mm-hmm. And so that for me has been a lifelong franchise and joy. In fact, we just rewatched the first episodes 1 through 6 just in the last few weeks. And in the filmmaking, particularly episodes 4 through 6, just show you the genius of George Lucas, how films that are, you know, 40 years old are just still looking as relevant and crisp today.
Yeah.
And then we eagerly started watching the new Disney ones that came along. And that's when the DEI started creeping in. And we just got to a point that we switched off. We just lost interest, because the characters just didn't appear real. And I understand that it's gone seriously downhill since then with all the reboots and spin-offs. So for those, and I think a lot of our listeners will remember Star Wars, I mean, it's been such a important part of many of Gen X's lives. What have Disney done in recent years that have just been, instead of big hits, have been huge misses?
Well, the quintessential lovely thing about the original Star Wars is that it's just such a basic, unabashed hero's journey. You start off with this naive farm boy who goes on an adventure. And everyone who watches that scene in the original Star Wars where Luke goes out and it's dusk and there's that binary sunset and he stares out into it and there's the beautiful strains of music from John Williams, everyone has to be stirred by that, because it's universal. It taps into these desires for otherness, to get away, for there's got to be something more in life and to have that. It's so beautiful. But now in the modern ones, there's like the character of Rey in the films, who's the quintessential what's called a Mary Sue, which is an overpowered, strong female character. And the problem with that is it takes away some of the magic and it takes away your involvement in the stories, because if someone is overpowered, then they can't go on a narrative arc and you can't go on that arc with them. If someone is more powerful than Luke Skywalker, and she's a chick, and she learns the Force stronger than him, and she can save all her friends in the galaxy and the universe, and she can heal wounds, that's great for the character, and it must be exciting, you know, for the writers in the writing room to be huffing their own farts and enjoying this fantasy. But it's boring when you're watching it on the screen. And then they did the Disney Plus shows, and again, just rehashes, very poorly written. There's one called Ahsoka, which has another strong female character who's bonding with her General Syndulla, who's also a strong female character. And together they're helping to nurture another strong female character who becomes stronger than Luke. And in the latest one, called The Acolyte, and we have lots of fun with this online, breaking it down, because it's hilarious. It's like some woke fever dream. Leslie Headland, a lesbian director, cast her lesbian wife in a role, and it's just strewn with all these gay characters, and it centers around the idea of a coven of lesbian space witches. And it got canceled after one season because no one watched it, because no one's especially into this and it doesn't connect with them. And if writers and showrunners are self-inserting their own fantasies and their own preoccupations into characters and stories, it creates these terrible blind spots where it's super enthralling and cathartic for them, but kind of tedious and a disconnect for everyone else. And so it got cancelled after one season. It had the lowest reviews and ratings ever. And then you get this terrible, annoying cycle where members of the cast will then go online and say, you know, the show wasn't given a chance because all these incels and incorrigible ne'er-do-wells and reactionaries online killed it before it had a chance. They start off before a project by saying to the sort of older fan base online, if you don't like it, don't watch it. It wasn't made for you. And then when the film or show or product bombs, then they go online and say, why didn't you give it a chance? Why did you not enjoy the show? And it's this cycle of flakiness that goes round and round. So everyone is essentially waiting for Kathleen Kennedy, who's the head of Lucasfilm, to finally step down. So we might get some reason come back to this.
Well, I know another one for us that we started watching when our children were younger, so they were primary age at this point, is they came out with the cartoon series of Star Wars Clone Wars. And it was, you know, excellent production values and good stories. They were stories that were
simple fun,
pitched right at that right level. And we got to the point where every Friday night that we would have like family night and either do make homemade fakeaways or get fish and chips or what have you. And we'd all sit down and watch the show together with, you know, with our two sons. And it was lovely.
Yep, kinetic, fast pace, zooming and lasers everywhere.
And a young Ahsoka appeared in that, and she was what you expected for as a young teenage Padawan and all the things that kids do. It was totally relatable. We loved it. And I read this morning, I literally read this morning, because they had spin-offs from that. And one of the key characters in that was a character called Captain Rex. And the clones, if anyone has watched Star Wars, you may remember Temuera Morrison in the films became very famous because he was Jango Fett, who they modeled the clones off. And so then when they did the episodes 1-3, there was basically little Temueras everywhere. I saw this morning on X, and I thought to myself, gosh, I'm so glad I'm talking to Nicholas today. Captain Rex said of Sister, she expressed her gender identity differently than her fellow troopers, and she'd had to hide who she truly is inside, so they gave her the name Sister as a constant reminder that she belonged. They've made a trans clone, Nicholas.
Trans clone. I can't get my head around that.
I know, right? Yeah. It's a clone. How can you have a trans clone? I mean, there's a lot of mental gymnastics that's gone on there.
That is, yeah. Because then it's sort of like, because then what does that say about other clones? And what does that say about the development of the clones?
I know. Exactly. But no, I mean, look.
So the drama of someone's own self-realization of their identity is more important to these people than the actual drama of the stories that's going on. You can have a brand that's a boy brand that girls can also love and enjoy. There's nothing wrong with that. It's fine. Just because something might not feature reform or diversity doesn't necessarily have to mean that it therefore suffers from a lack of diversity. But no, they can't sort of get their head around that idea.
Yeah. So the other, and before we jump off Star Wars, so the other area as well, of course, was The Mandalorian. And that came out. And again, we loved season one. We thought, well, okay, this is
quite good.
It was all right. Yeah. It was a bit again. And there was some nice characters, you know.
It was all right. Yeah.
And even Gina Carano, who played this exceptionally strong feminine character, she was believable. She did not feel contrived.
And then, that's right.
And then, of course, the cancellation happened, you know, lockdowns, pandemic, and she was cancelled for sort of being critical of lockdown policy. And I know she is funded by, I think, is it Daily Wire, are now funding her against Disney for wrongful dismissal of what they did in terms of her contract. What sort of ripples do things like that have through the industry or on Disney, do you think?
It's hard to pass that one. I've sort of gone back and forth over that because I didn't like some of the tweets she sent. I thought they were a bit gratuitous and harsh. But there's also a lot of hypocrisy where there were a lot of people, other employees who were kind of doing the equal and opposite that were also kind of a bit obtuse as well. And of course, you know, Disney has the right to not want to work with Gina Carano if that's their values and their policies. But there is some hypocrisy there. And so she's filed a lawsuit. And the interesting thing there is not whether she'll win it or not, but the discovery process, when they would have to go through all the emails and the internal communications at Disney to find out. So there could be some interesting little rotten elements there that could be revealed. So that would be fun. But yeah, I go back and forth on her because I think she was just kind of like, you know, she used to be in the WWE as a former wrestler. She wasn't like the greatest actress in the world, but some of my colleagues in the ecosystem suddenly thought that, you know, she was a combination of Joan of Arc and Meryl Streep. And so, you know, the truth is somewhere in between, basically.
Yeah, yeah. But you're right, though. It is that discovery process because it is
what a corporation fears the most, you know.
Yes, which is why so many of them settle, particularly in the United States. I just can't help feeling, have these studios actually forgotten who they're making television or films for?
Oh, completely, yeah. Their mindset isn't, will it be financially and commercially and critically successful? For a lot of them, their first priority is this ought to be made, because you can use these products as a vehicle for messaging. And they're also the disconnect that, rather than thinking that, you know, they can be political and other people who differ from them can also be political, they take the mindset that they are inherently correct and ideal and ahead of the curve, and other people are political. So that's their mindset. And they live in a very particular social milieu, which they want to kind of reflect in the product and the entertainment, which sadly leaves a lot of people behind. But I think we're starting to get to the point where, you know, big studios can only bleed so much money before things have to go through some kind of course correction. And I think we're just sort of teetering on that, because it's, you know, it can't be absurd forever.
Well, and I guess it doesn't help, though, when you've got films after lots of bombs, you'll get an outlier like Barbie.
Yeah.
That was incredibly successful. So then I guess that would sort of buoy them thinking, oh, okay, no, well, this actually does work. There is commercial success here. Ugh. I mean, and you only just need to look. I mean, we've talked about Star Wars, obviously, Doctor Who, Trek, Lord of the Rings.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, it's never ending. Doctor Who was the most egregious. That was pumped full of identity politics. With the new Doctor they got, and it was just full of crazy stuff. And it's had the worst ratings in 60 years since it first came out. So from the beloved days in 1963, where kids were terrified and leapt behind the couch, enthralled by these Daleks that were just creatures that just hated you, to now, yeah, the lowest ratings in 60 years because of this identity politics indulgence that they threw in. And the Rings of Power is this walking skin suit of the Lord of the Rings, which has bored everyone to death. And also, you know, they even have a scene where the orcs are portrayed as, you know, protective fathers who don't especially want to fight, rather than just being these evil gargoyles that hate you. So this moral relativism creeps in as well. You know, people are misunderstood. People have their circumstances ought to be taken into account and all this kind of stuff. No, orcs, put on your shoddy armor and try and kill people. That's all I want.
Yeah, well, always, of course, the fandom was, particularly when you've got franchises like this. As you said, Doctor Who, 1963? Yeah. I mean, it's been around for such a long time. So the fandom was always key.
Mm-hmm. And they had, in the last 6 months of Doctor Who, they had the companion was transgender, who chastises the Doctor for being a male-presenting Time Lord. There's a woman in a wheelchair who fires laser guns out of her wheelchair and says, don't make me the problem when the stairs. They go back in time, and who's the guy who famously the apple dropped on his head? I almost forget.
Isaac Newton.
Yeah, he's portrayed by an Indian actor. The Doctor, there's like this little implication he was having an affair with Harry Houdini. The new Doctor cries in every episode. There's a gay kiss in another episode. And instead of the Doctor being kind of like this ancient creature who's kind of like a bit dotty, and is not perturbed by things, and his companions are. Instead, they have Shuti Gatwa as a Doctor who's got this kind of frenetic energy, and it's all very silly and over the top, and it's full of pizzazz. And you don't want that from the Doctor. The Doctor Who should be, it's that post-war kind of English dottiness to it, you know, like wearing long scarves or having a sprig of celery in your cricket jacket, that kind of stuff.
Musty tweed and all
exactly,
of that.
Exactly, yeah. Mm-hmm.
So then you brought up that thing with Isaac Newton. One of my particular bugbears my particular bugbears is when they take a beloved character, whether it be from a previous film, franchise, or a book, and I'm a big reader, and they not only gender swap them, but they race swap them. Nicholas, this must stop.
Yeah, this is what launched my channel in the first place. There was a streaming series about former English Tudor Queen Anne Boleyn, the real actual historical figure, played by Jodie Turner-Smith, who's a black actress. And I couldn't get my head around this idea. It's called colorblind casting. Now, if you're doing, for example, ballet, or you're doing Shakespeare, then it doesn't matter what the race or ethnicity of someone is particularly, because it's so transcendent and it's aesthetically beautiful, and it's also made up. But if you're taking real-life historical figures and characters and you're having this attitude of colorblind casting, then it's so incongruous that it's kind of feeble and weird. There was a show of Vikings where an 11th century Danish Viking noblewoman is played by a black actress, and it's such a emperor's clothes moment of this is where we're at. This is kind of new concepts and definitions of normalized identity in the name of inclusivity. You can have inclusivity all over the place. Tell stories that we haven't heard of before from different locales and pockets of history that we could be illuminated by. People are starving for that kind of stuff. But if you take real historical figures and race swap them, it's so weird. So that's what started my channel in the first place.
I mean, I know this is a work of fiction, but Bridgerton. So yeah. I love me a good Georgian period, you know, period drama. I mean, I'm a middle-aged woman. I mean, that's...
I get you. I hear
you. Yeah, that is totally my wheelhouse. I watched one episode of Bridgerton, and it literally looked like a whole bunch of millennials playing dress up. And I was like, wow, I'm terrified, absolutely terrified the day that they honestly make Darcy a woman and a black woman, and they put it in a lesbian relationship with Elizabeth. I mean, I'll be done that they do that.
The new Bridgerton features a lesbian relationship at its core, so that's the main driving story arc. But there was a Bridgerton, one of the recent series, where Queen Charlotte, of course, is played by a black actress, and the whole thing is that her and King George, I think it is, Prince George, it's the great experiment how they can lead by example and show how racial inclusivity can be wonderful. And you can, actors can portray how it really was, and that can be gritty and authentic. You don't have to, like, show black people in socioeconomic parity as part of the gentry in Georgian England in order for everyone to be happy. You can tell stories where the black characters are marginalized and are at the bottom of society. But if the actors are great, they can bring that to life. They can make it sympathetic. They can make it compelling. That's great. But no, if you do this like frothy nonsense, you're doing this weird historical revisionism, it becomes very strange. And history is very delicate. I think it was the Observer. They did a survey where it showed that I think 1/3 of young people think that Winston Churchill is a fictional character. So history is very delicate. And if you do this kind of stuff, it might make young people feel empowered, I suppose, if you're from a marginalized background, to see this revised and reimagined stuff. But then again, there's going to be a flip side, because if you're a young person and you see, you know, that that famous old scientist, I've forgotten his name again, with the apple.
Oh, Isaac Newton.
Yeah, if you see him portrayed, you know, like as an Indian actor, but then eventually you're going to get to high school and you're going to open up your high school textbook and you're going to, oh, no, he was just another white dude. So I don't know what they're trying to achieve there.
No. Where is the line between, though, authenticity and being contrived? Because you can have these race swaps and they be quite successful. Like, I mean, one that springs to mind for me is Nick Fury, the Samuel L. Jackson character in Marvel. I mean, he owned that.
It's Samuel L. Jackson. Come on.
Yeah, and also Morgan Freeman. I mean, he was played Alfred in Batman. I think, was it Alfred? Mm-hmm. Yeah, I mean, same thing. You know, like you've got...
The Shawshank Redemption, his character of Red was originally like an Irish character, so yeah.
Yeah, exactly. So if you've got gravitas, you can do it. So how can they make it more authentic? Where are they missing the mark, do you think?
Well, the line, as I said, is real historical characters... You rub people up the wrong way and you annoy them. There was a documentary looking at Cleopatra, and you know, it had this notion that they depicted Cleopatra as like a dark-skinned or sort of African person, and then the Egyptians actually got annoyed about it because, no, this isn't who she was, and you're kind of reimagining our cultural icon. So it's that wonderful thing with the flakier and more strident excesses of progressivism, is that you get yourself into a tangle because you're trying to be progressive in this way, but you annoy people progressively in this other way, that, you know, you're culturally impinging yourself on a different culture and annoying them and rubbing them up the wrong way. And there's a new game coming up. I forget the name of it, but it's the main character is a samurai in feudal Japan who's played, and he's African. He's an African black samurai, based off this dubious tiny little scrap of history that they dug up. And of course, a lot of Japanese got kind of annoyed by this as well, because what are you doing with depicting our culture this way? And so that game has been shoved back another financial quarter while they try and figure out what to do with it. So yeah, it's hilarious stuff.
Yeah, well, particularly with the Japanese. Wow. So is there anyone out there that's bucking this trend? If you're like me, I mean, I haven't been to the cinema since Top Gun Maverick.
Wow, that's going back a bit.
Yeah, yeah. And I have to admit, I thoroughly enjoyed it. And it was...
Oh, yeah.
It was great because it didn't abuse you as a fan. Because, I mean, I was a teenager when the first one came out. It didn't abuse you as a fan. I mean, hey, nearly 3 hours of Tom Cruise. I was happy. Plus, the new cast of characters. I was happy. They had strong female characters in there, but they didn't feel contrived.
They felt naturalistic, you know, they're helping things along. It's good. Yeah. Interpersonal relationships.
Walked out of the cinema, felt pumped. Have not felt remotely interested in going back to the cinema for anything since then. So give me some hope, Nicholas. Where will I find something that will get me feeling positive about spending my dollar, my $20 to go and sit and be entertained for a couple of hours?
Honestly, it's a little thin on the ground. And I don't know where you're going to spend your money. And going to the cinema can be a bit dismal these days. There's like five or six other people and, you know, it doesn't feel like a great experience. So, yeah, I think maybe keep your money to yourself for a little bit while this kind of shakes out and resolves itself. Mm. So, yeah, sorry to be the bearer of bad news.
Bad news. Do you find this? My husband and I re-watching a lot of series, particularly run through the back end of the 90s and the early 2000s, before this DEI monster took hold.
Yeah, the 90s feel fun now, and there's kind of a nice little irony about the 90s, because the 90s were defined by angst and, you know, millennial tension. And that's kind of cute in retrospect, considering what we've been through since then. The 90s were kind of a holiday from history. And so, yeah, it's cool to go back to that. Because they were, you know, like you'd watch Trainspotting, or you'd watch The Matrix and films like that, or Seven. Gritty, cool, exciting, fun stuff. So, yeah, that's a good period. But, I don't know exactly what you're going to be looking for at the moment.
I interviewed Kevin Sorbo a couple of weeks ago.
All right.
And, yeah, and of course, he got cancelled. He's a very conservative Christian, always has been a very conservative Christian. Mm-hmm. And he realises that, and he's very strong in his opinions, and he has rubbed some in Hollywood up the wrong way. Mm-hmm. So his solution to this is to create his own studio. And the market is large. He said he's doing 3 to 4 films a year to an audience of around, it might be 8 million Americans that want just wholesome stories.
Yeah, I'm a bit wary about this because there was one good film. It was a human trafficking film that blew up last year. It came out from quite a conservative studio. So there's something there that works. But the Daily Wire is starting to produce content. And it's a little cynical because humor is quite difficult at the best of times. And conservatism still hasn't quite got how to do humor yet. Mm. Because there's always an undertow of, you know, competitiveness and toughness, which doesn't quite work in humor. So they haven't quite figured that out. They tried with a film called Ballers, I think it is, you know, taking the idea of transgender athletes and trying to play with that. So, and there was also, you know, the Snow White remake is coming out, which has been almost canceled and held back and you know, nearly shit canned several times because of Rachel Zegler kind of mouthing off about the original Snow White. So they've had to reshoot it. And then I think the Daily Wire or some other conservative outlet is putting out their own Snow White. And so there's kind of a mean-spiritedness there, which I don't, it can be counterproductive because you're just echo chambering entertainment, which is not a prospect that I don't think anyone should particularly relish. I don't think you should start from an ideological position. You should start from a position of creativity and the creative urge to aesthetically, you know, develop something. But in Kevin Sorbo's defense, you know, with the cancelling of The Acolyte, so many Acolyte fans online started, you know, to try get YouTube to cancel the channels of some people that I quite like, which of course fell flat on its face. So they can be very vicious and vindictive online. And someone said that, you know, Kevin Sorbo, he doesn't go online and try and cancel people if a Christian-themed film didn't work at the box office. So there is that.
Mm-hmm. Because one of the things we talked about in our interview is how he had a very successful film, which when it opened at number two against a Marvel film that particular weekend. It did very, very well. And on the back of that success, he got called into Netflix about supplying films for an aspirational theme throughout Netflix, which is quite nice. And as he said, there are people that want genuine true stories told accurately and told well.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I agree.
He said the talks never went any further. They toed and froed and toed and froed, and he said it just sort of didn't happen.
Mm.
Do you sort of wonder that, again, these corporations like Netflix aren't necessarily looking at what fans want, but then they will have Ricky Gervais,
mm-hmm.
who is probably one of the most successful comedians on their channel, Dave Chappelle.
Yeah, I was just about to say, yeah. So they're interesting, Netflix, because I was actually quite surprised, because after the Dave Chappelle's Netflix special, where he got into some hot water about some transgender content, which I thought was fine, a lot of Netflix staff, they started to protest or demonstrate. And Netflix, no, they just coolly issued a statement saying, you know, if you have a problem with this kind of content, then perhaps Netflix isn't the place for you. So I was surprised and quite, I suppose, heartened by that. So that was a good little sign. They're such a monolith, I suppose, that money is always, you know, going to be at the heart of everything. But that was a good sign, I think. Yeah.
So it will be interesting to see whether they start sort of changing that content, because I know that from a streaming perspective, we use them primarily to watch stuff which is historical.
Mm-hmm.
And a lot of the new stuff coming forward, I can't tell you how many times I watch a single episode of something and just go, ugh.
Yeah, it's true. And the way that people, these companies, rate their metrics and viewerships, they'll do it like, you know, you watched for more than 3 minutes counts as an episode watch. So their facts and figures can be quite dubious. Mm-hmm. But yeah, it's hard for a show to get past that crucial first episode stage. Probably the same as when you go into a bookstore and you read a novel for the first one or two pages, and then you make that psychological decision if you're going to stay with it. Same sort of thing. Yeah.
Well, I think it was in one of your episodes, was it The Rings of Power? You were saying that only something like 37% of people actually watch from episode one all the way through to, what's it, episode eight?
Yeah, it's astonishing. Most series will have a drop off, maybe down to 50 or 60% of viewers will stick it out through a season. And Rings of Power, which is supposed to be this prestige television show that cost $1 billion to make, sunk down to only 37 of people stuck around to finish watching it, because it wasn't connecting with audiences. It was too bloated. There's far too many characters. Galadriel is the heroine, who is, of course, super powerful, knows everything, is brilliant, is always right about everything, is the perfect Mary Sue. She can fling herself around, you know, this 5'4" actress with these obliging stuntmen and these ridiculous set pieces. And people just weren't buying it. They're just not into it. People are very fond and very protective of Peter Jackson's Lord of the Rings. And Peter Jackson, you know, very famously went on record as saying, we didn't want to push our own messaging and our own ideas in the story. We wanted to stay faithful to Tolkien. And yeah, so that modern show, it lacks any sense of themes. It lacks any sense of narrative coherence. It lacks any sense of fellowship, literally, like in the Fellowship of the Ring. It lacks, they don't know how to do humor. They have these torturous analogies and metaphors where they try to sound pseudo-Tolkien-like. And I did a whole episode on my live stream where we tried to decide by brackets which is the worst tortured metaphors that they use in the show, because there's no shortage of them. What is it? I can't even remember them. They're so terrible. You should look them up because they're hilarious. It's these writers trying to be ornate with their writing, but they don't have a clue how to do it. So again, it's what is the term? It's ersatz, you know? So ersatz means like margarine instead of butter, or fake coffee instead of the real thing. So it's ersatz kind of entertainment. And it's really dispiriting to watch that they could blow $1 billion on this prestige flop, which is so self-indulgent. And we haven't even talked about New Zealand film and the state of that.
Oh, that was my next question. You just presaged it. So where are we at in this country? I know someone who's working currently on Spartacus. So there are productions going on. So what's your take on what's happening here at home?
Well, I would encourage anyone to go look at the New Zealand Film Commission's a slate of projects that they've given funding to. And it is almost hilarious. It's like a fever dream of stupid, contrived nonsense that is no one is going to watch, and they're just weeing money away on these puerile little projects that are designed for an audience of one, which is the writer, to indulge themselves. New Zealand has always famously been able to punch above its weight in cinema. During the 90s, when the Australians were putting, you know, Muriel Queen of the Desert and
so much good stuff.
Priscilla, Queen of the Desert, and Muriel's Wedding and stuff like that. But here we had what Sam Neill called the cinema of unease. And, you know, it was great. It was sophisticated stuff. But, yeah, we haven't had a hit film in about 10 years, which is very strange for our culture. And it's because we have this permissive culture of incredible flakiness and self-indulgence and a film commission that's very indulgent of that. And it's sad because no one's going to watch these films. And New Zealand has lost that kind of energy and claimed being able to punch above its weight in cinema. And the same thing with music. You know, we always punched above our weight with Crowded House, with Split Ends, that whole phase, the Flying Nun in the 80s. And then and even like 10 years ago, we had Lord, 9 weeks at the top of the charts, and Lady Hawk and The Naked and Famous, these cool acts. But we haven't had a cool song or album in 10 years. Because everything is flakily collegial and nice. And it's all about the vibe, Marie. It's not about...
it's the vibe of the thing.
Yeah, it's not if you can hum the tune or it's a recognizable hit melody. It's all about the vibe. That's why people go to 660 concerts. No one on the street can name more than one 660 song, but they're heralded as like this titan of the industry. So it's a huge disconnect there, and it's kind of sad.
And, of course, we've had to even borrow from Dennis DeNuto, which was Australian, but there you go, with the vibe of the thing. Mm-hmm. It is really, really sad because I think Hunt for the Wilder People was the last film that the Film Commission gave money to. That was profitable. Stephen Meagher, did you see
I saw that.
Scathing.
Yeah.
Scathing. And you know what really upset me about that is it literally took a dying man.
Yep, exactly, 100%, yeah. To just pull back that curtain and give a sense of what it looks like back there. Yeah. It was really sad.
Really, really sad. And also the separation too between New Zealand On Air and the New Zealand Film Commission. I think there is a certain amount of making sense to pull those two things together. So you talked about film. What about New Zealand television? What are your thoughts with what we're doing there?
I mean, there was a stage a year ago where it actually looked like we were TV3 was going to go down the drain, and we were going to go back to 1989 with having one news broadcast. Crazy stuff. So that's really a worry, and they've cut everything down to the bone. They're just going to have the basic broadcasts. And on the one hand, I sympathize with them because it's a very diverse media market. People get their content from all over the place, across the world. You know, traditional news media is becoming like a plurality of where people get their stuff. It's losing its influence. So I get those international forces. But I also think, you know, I look at TV1 News and I see, you know, the news reporters, the guys are wearing off-the-rack, misshapen suits that don't look proper. And the ladies always position themselves in, you know, fiercely blowing wind on the top of a hill, and they're having to, like, get the hair out of their face. And it's still got that little amateurism to it. And so I think they're also partly to blame. The media, like the Herald, getting more banal, I think, in a lot of its content and just relying on importing stuff from international news outlets, which makes it kind of pointless because why not go to those international news outlets in the first place? You know, for the last year, I was writing a lot of pieces of New Zealand content and sociocultural stuff for international outlets, but I just so ran dry because there's nothing happening here. It's become really boring, to be honest with you. Which maybe is a good thing, Maybe that's, like the Chinese proverb, it's cursed is he who lives in interesting times. So maybe we're in the right. But I had a little tweet here, wrote down just from the other day. It's from Newsroom, and it's a book review with the heading, Pip Adam enjoys the first contemporary realist novel she's read in 6 years by a Pakeha cis man. So that's the title of the review. Around. So not doing too flash there either.
And when you look at television, so, I mean, obviously all the news dilemmas aside, and we're certainly tracking that very closely here at Reality Check, but with that aside, and you look at drama, I mean, Outrageous Fortune was hugely successful. Oh, and it was
monster hit,
this wonderful sort of, me growing up in that era, the slice of Kiwiness, and it was unashamedly Kiwi. Yeah. And look at the careers that has now launched internationally.
Yeah.
The one little sort of bright light that has sort of actually, it's bubbled along just quietly, and it's now got a lot of international success, and I think you know where I'm going with this, is The Brokenwood Mysteries. It's New Zealand's version of Midsummer Murders.
Oh.
And having been someone that was a huge Midsummer Murder fan, it is our sort of take on it. And again, they're just a collection of delightful stories, well told, engaging characters. They don't rely on lots of special effects and the like. And they are now, they've been, I think, 8 seasons they've been chucking along.
Really? That's great. I didn't know.
So there you go. There you go. So why don't you check out that? Make a cup of tea, get yourself a digestive, put your fluffy slippers on, Nicholas, and watch The Brokenwood Mysteries. Yeah, it's insane. So let people know about where they can find you, what are some of the content, some of the things that you do on the channel. So if they want to connect with what you're doing, and I mean, I'm certainly enjoying it. You've got a fan in me. So where will they find it, and what have you got coming up?
Well, the Echo Chamberlain YouTube channel, and what I do is maybe once a week I'll post up a video, which is always good, and then every 2 weeks on a Wednesday morning there's the Echo Chamberlain live stream where I meet with my good friends from around the globe, and we talk about popular culture for a couple of hours, and we sort of break it down, and doing it live is always great fun. The chat is always great. And we have wonderful guests that come on. So it's a good hang. So I recommend people check that out. Also, I'll do occasionally, maybe every 5 or 6 weeks, I'll do a Critical Drinkers open bar and go on that, which is a huge amount of fun. And there's also BSUP, which is Best Show in the Universe, probably, which is hosted by a couple of great guys. And that's another live stream, which is a great fun. So yeah, they're all out there and they're good fun. I'm a novelist in my heart of heart is what I do. So my novels, Broken Play and How to Disappear Completely, which came out last year, you can check out some RNZ interviews about them. That's always good. And you can find me doing columns in Sky News in Australia, occasionally in The Spectator, and occasionally on MSNBC as well. So I'm sort of all around the traps. Been trying for God knows how long, Marie, to sort of get regular gigs in the New Zealand media, because I thought that was the apotheosis. That's the Mount Parnassus. That's where you go. And then I kind of thought, maybe I'm going to just kind of go elsewhere and do my own thing. And that's where I've kind of been.
Well, good on you. I'm loving the content. Are those novels, any Kiwi, because you're a New Zealand writer, one hopes that one can pop into that Rare Dinosaur now, an independent bookstore, and pick one up?
Yeah, there'll be some copies knocking about. You can also get them online through Unoya Press and other places online. So do check it out, because, one puts one's heart and soul into this. And if you work it out, it's probably about 0.2 cents per hour when you're working as a writer. Along those lines.
Hey, look, I'm a hen nutter. I completely understand your tortured pain on that, Nicholas. I really do. Hey, look, it has been an utter joy to chat to you this morning. This is Nicholas Shepherd, as he said, at Echo Chamberlain on YouTube. Plus, we will make sure all those other links that he mentioned are in the show notes. Hey, thanks, Nick. I really enjoyed it this morning.
Thanks, Marina. Absolute pleasure. Great to be able to natter with you.
Right, don't disappear, everybody. Still more great content here to come with here on Reality Check. Take care.
The RCR shop has great gift ideas. From great-looking tees, hoodies, caps, tote bags, bumper stickers and more, the RCR shop is now open at www.realitycheck.radio/shop.